We're taking a look at your pet's health here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. My guest today, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, professor of veterinary medicine at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Great to have her back, and thank you so much for listening in. Questions for Sandy, I hope you'll join in at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can post a question on our Facebook page. Just go to The Larry Mueller Show. And if you got a kind of a fun picture of your pet, I hope you'll post that as well. Those are fun. We were just talking about your pet.
Oh,
Sandy.
Yes. Actually, I just sent his picture in for this thing in Bark magazine called The Smiling Dog. Mm-hmm. Bulldozer, my male bulldog, decided that, he's light tan and white. He found a nice muddy spot in the backyard. We have a dog door. Mm-hmm. And he went out and probably spent the whole morning rolling in mud and then came in and he is just black from head to toe. And he just looked up at the camera with this big bulldog smile on his face like, I am just the happiest dog covered with mud like this. And, you know, you had to laugh. But yeah. So we'll see. Maybe he'll end up in the magazine. Never know.
You never know. Well, we would be fun to see some on the Facebook page. So if you've got a photo of your pet, send it in. And lots of calls already online, but let's talk a bit about feeding and about obesity.
And measuring food. And You know what? I have firsthand experience with how bad I am at measuring. I just got back from a week in Colorado. I took the two dogs and my daughter and her boyfriend. And a whole bunch of people went and I pre-measured all of my dog's dog food. They get a cup of an 8-ounce measuring cup of dry food twice a day and then a little bit of canned on top. And so I pre-measured it all, but then forgot to bring the measuring cup with me. And I'm like, I can eyeball it. I've been doing this for how many years? So we ran out of 2 days early. So it just goes to show you that eyeballing how much you think like, oh yeah, I've been measuring a cup out for years. Even a veterinarian can mess up. And there was a study that was done where they, measured it out the food and weighed it and then had the owners marked it with the cup and said, here's how much you need to be able to feed your dog. And then they would have the owners scoop out what they thought was the right amount, and they weighed it and compared it to the actual amount. And most of the people, anywhere from like 2% over to 28% over, even when the measuring cup is marked. So a while ago, the Hill's company came out with this. I called it Jenny Craig in a box dog food. It was all pre-measured little bags of food that you just had to grab the right number of bags. And I thought, this is ridiculous, all this packaging. But now when I see a study like this, even when I mark a cup for the owner, it's likely going to be over, the dog's going to be overfed.
Okay. Oh, boy. Tom in Madison has a question for you. So let's just go to Tom. Hi, Tom. Thank you for calling.
Yes, good morning. I have a question about my cat. He's a diabetic. And he's been on insulin for about 9 weeks. About the last 3 weeks, I've been giving him 3 units in the morning and 3 units in the evening. And he's been eating a high-protein cat food, a wet food, mm-hmm. The 50% range. And but since this time, I've noticed that his water consumption and urination and bowel movements has really dropped off, And I was just wondering, is that normal?
That is normal.
Great.
Because when, cats are diabetic and their blood sugar is really high, they're going to be passing that sugar in their urine, which carries water. So one of the first signs that an owner will see is, boy, my cat's drinking a lot of water. And look at the size of the urine puddles in the litter box. They're huge. And that's one of the things that clues us in that we may have something going on. So when you start treating a cat that's diabetic, obviously you're going to see if you're doing it well, a decrease in water consumption and a decrease in urine output. It's really important, though, in those first few weeks to make sure that you're going in and having the blood sugar levels monitored to make sure that you're not overdoing it. Many cats that are diabetic, sometimes you just wave the insulin bottle over them for a week or two and they don't need it anymore, depending on the kind of insulin you use. Most people are using a type called glargine insulin in cats. And I've had many cats that have reverted to a non-insulin state where they didn't need it to be able to stay healthy. But the decrease in the amount of stool that's being produced, again, when cats are diabetic, their body is starved for energy. And so they tend to be eating eating a ton of food and, as a result, pooping a lot. So if they're back to eating normal amounts, and especially when you're using a high-protein, highly digestible food that are designed for diabetic cats, they do tend to produce less stool with it, too. So it sounds like your cat's right on track, but make sure you keep up with those vet visits.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, can I ask you another question? You know, he is somewhat overweight, and, well, maybe he's obese. You know?
Okay.
But anyway, I was wondering, you know, how much should I be feeding him, really? I feed him maybe, we got him on a can a day, maybe, and some little high-protein or dry food also.
Yeah, this is something that by kind of going back and looking in your medical records, and this would be something that your veterinarian would have to do, to find out what your cat's ideal weight would be. And there's often a time in the cat's history where they were normal weight, and then all of a sudden over the years, their weight creeps up. So sometimes it goes back to, we have to go back and look at when they were, you know, a year or two of age, kind of what did they weigh then? That would be considered their ideal weight. There's a formula that we plug their ideal weight into, and then that kind of spits out how many calories a day they need to be taking in. And so that's something that your veterinarian would have to do, because every cat's going to be different depending on their weight. Most cats that are needing to be on a diet need around 200 calories per day. So you have to find out how many calories are in the can of food and everything that you're feeding the cat, so we can find out how much to feed. So it takes a little bit of, you know, sitting down with the calculator. But I think that if you just call your veterinarian, they could very easily do that for you.
Mm-hmm. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call, Tom. Sarah in Zion, Illinois, we're going to you next. Hi, Sarah.
Okay, hi there. I'm, you know, you'll probably just tell me this is hopeless, but I just need to ask, because my sister, it's my sister's cat who I would like to adopt, but the problem is, okay, first of all, my sister lives in a house with five cats. I live in an apartment. I have two cats.
Okay.
And my sister has this wonderful cat named Polly, who's just the sweetest, smartest, most loving thing, but she poops and pees all over the house.
Oh, my goodness. Yes.
Yeah. And my sister's tried a few things. I know she tried some sort of sedative or antidepressant or something like that. I don't know if she's still doing that. She gave her her own litter box, but the other cats use it. You know, she can't separate it out. And
this is a tough situation because, you know, with five cats in your sister's home, you know, is it a problem with the social dynamics between the cats, or is it a problem with where the litter boxes are located or what's put in the litter boxes? With five cats in the household, I would hope that your sister has at least six litter boxes in six different locations in the home rather than having them all grouped together. And so if you were to be adding this cat into your home with living in a smaller apartment, you already have two cats. One of the things when you're adopting and bringing a new cat in is you have to stop and think, can I meet this cat's needs? You know, can I be adding in an extra litter box? So for three cats in your apartment, you'd be looking at four litter boxes, always one more than the cat number. That seems to cut down on some of the stressors where they can always find a clean one. Or if you've got one cat that happens to be a bully, she can get to a litter box that, you know, that she may not be able to if the bully's guarding, you know, the other litter box. So there's a real reason why we like to have that many litter boxes. And, you know, so I'd go back to your sister. First of all, it sounds like, you know, if she's done a little bit, work on trying, you know, adding extra litter boxes in uncovered boxes, scooping them and keeping them clean daily, evaluating what kind of kitty litter she's using, preferably using a soft, scoopable, sandy litter. And it looks like the carbon-based odor eliminators seem to be preferred by cats than any of the, like, baking soda or anything like that. But trying to go with an unscented litter if you can.
Oh.
So hopefully they'll be able to keep the cat if they go about doing everything right. But I think sometimes people just get frustrated and they want to rehome the cat and they haven't tried everything that's possible.
Yep.
She says she uses a cat attract litter. She's tried that and it doesn't help any.
Yeah, there's one that a veterinarian's made that I call it, like, it almost smells like silage. And so for cats that like to eliminate outdoors, it does provide kind of an organic type smell to the litter. And again, if she just changed the litter and only has two litter boxes for five cats, that may still not be the right, you know, the right number. So it's something that I hope her veterinarian has sat down, and I have people draw out a floor plan of their home, mark in where the litter boxes are located, where the accidents are occurring. We chit chat about the social dynamics between the cats in the household, and then, you know, make some decisions as to what would be a logical way of approaching an elimination behavior problem kind of based on that. And, you know, sometimes we do need medical management, but usually when we've got a cat that's urinating and defecating out of the box, typically it's more of a management issue rather than, you know, a marking type behavior that would respond to medical management.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. And Kiana in Madison, on to you now. Hi.
Hi, Sandy. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about what you know now about Promaris. About 2-3 months ago, you were highly recommending it for the use for flea control with cats and I think possibly dogs as well. And are you aware that the company has agreed to discontinue manufacturing and sales?
Yeah, and I have never recommended Promaris. In fact, I have never recommended it for a couple of reasons. One, it's a very large volume. The Promaris product that they make for cats just gets fleas. It does not get ticks. The Promaris product that was made for dogs gets fleas and ticks, but it smells absolutely horrible. In fact, the first time it was launched, I went to a meeting and one of the veterinarians at the site at the trade show called it the new flea tick / weight loss program for dogs, because they say if you put it on, you got to walk your dog for a couple of hours to let the smell dissipate. So that was one of the big concerns. But the reason why it's been voluntarily removed from the market is that it has been associated with causing a skin problem, primarily in dogs, that's called pemphigus foliaceus, or PF, which is an immune-mediated skin disease that's pretty nasty. And it showed up in a number of cases. We're not really sure, because when you look at the active ingredients in there, Amitraz, which is one of the ingredients that's used in it, has been used in a lot of other things, and it doesn't seem to be a cause of causing PF in dogs. And then when you look at the active ingredient that controlled fleas, which is also in the cat product, it didn't show up in cats. So their thought was maybe it's something in the carrier or whatever that is causing this immune response. So it did get pulled off the market. There are lots of great products out there. But anytime you use a new product on your pet, you need to be watching to make sure that they're not one of these uncommon individuals that can have a local reaction. And big thing is, if you've got more than one pet in the household, try to keep them separate so that they're not licking it, because it's not meant to be, you know, given orally. And, just a new thing that's out, the Frontline has kind of been the industry standard for flea and tick control. Mariel has come out with a kind of new improved, they don't want to call it improved Frontline, because Frontline's a great product, but it's called CertiFect, and it's the extra ingredient that they've added in is Amitraz, which is the ingredient that was in Promaris that got pulled off the market, but very small level of it. But it just seems that little bit extra ingredient really improves the tick efficacy of the product. And I'm not recommending that everybody switch over to that, but if you're in a heavy tick area, lots and lots of ticks, and you're seeing tick breakthrough, it might be something to consider switching over to. But if you're happy and you're using Frontline, it's working, stick with that.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. We have, on our Facebook page, we have some photos. A new Springer puppy, Barley, Carolyn says.
Very
cute.
We're picking
up on Thursday, 5 weeks old when we get her. Is that about right?
Well, that's pretty young. Usually we like to see puppies stay with the litter until they're 6 to 8 weeks of age. 5 weeks, is a little on the young side. So hopefully by the time they get the puppy next weekend, it'll be, 6 weeks of age, and they can get it into a vet clinic and have it checked out and make sure everything's healthy with the puppy.
Okay. Here's another one. That's a wedding picture,
oh,
I think.
My goodness.
Wedding day with our pups. No one fits.
More and more people are including their pets in wedding ceremonies, and they actually, like different wedding planners and things, they kind of specialize in including pets. So, I don't think my dogs would probably do real well. And plus, I don't see myself getting married anytime in the near future. But, you have to look at whether the pet can cope with crowds and, cameras and posing and the long hours and so on that's involved with being part of a wedding party.
Here's an email from Sue. Please tell us who's right or wrong. My husband and I are in disagreement. We own two litter-trained cats. We let them outside. would they relieve themselves outdoors?
Yeah, many cats do. And so, in fact, you know, if they can find an area that they can dig in, they may, you know, some loose soil or something like that, by all means. You know, some cats may, you know, be litter trained as well as wanting to go outside. And being outside, they may do more like urine marking and things if they're smelling other cats. But make sure that if you are letting your cats outside, that they're on a broad spectrum dewormer, that they're on flea and tick control, that they're on heartworm preventative. Definitely have to change what you do from the preventive medicine standpoint for an indoor outdoor cat versus just a strictly indoor cat.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, professor of veterinary medicine at the University of Wisconsin Madison School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears Poisson, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you'd like to join in with a question or comment, our lines are all filled right at the moment. The number is 1-800-642-1234. You can post an email at talk@wpr.org or post a question or even a photo. Those are fun, too, at our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We have an email from Debbie. I have a 14-and-a-half-year-old lab shepherd retriever dog. She's been in great health until the last few months. Her back legs give out once in a while, a couple times a day that we see, and a few times she will trip over her front leg. Is this just old nerves wearing out, or could it be something else?
Well, I really think that, you know, this is something that having a good, thorough exam done, sometimes we'll just see dogs as they get older with arthritis, they lose some of their muscle mass because they're not up and moving, and they're just weaker from that standpoint. Yeah. But we can also see issues with things like spinal cord tumors and other neurologic issues that can affect dogs as they get older as well. So a good, thorough physical exam would try to, you know, differentiate. Is this just a musculoskeletal problem, or is this a neurologic problem? Or maybe it's a combination of the two. And for a 14-year-old dog, boy, you know, I just got back from hiking in the mountains, and I know that just, you know, my balance isn't quite as what it used to be. And you know, tripping over rocks a little bit more. So, you know, it may just be age.
Barb in Wauwatosa, on to you. Hi, Barb.
Hi, thank you. My dog is 10 days, it's 10 days since his emergency laminectomy.
Mm-hmm.
And he's doing well with pain control, and he's eating. And he went into surgery with not having any sensation of his back legs. And I have two concerns. One is he's incontinent at times of urine, and the other one, his right leg doesn't seem as strong as his left. What is your thoughts on that?
Yeah, surgery that was done on your dog was probably because your dog had a slipped disc or something and needed to have the spinal cord freed up with having lack of deep pain, a sensation with no sensation. That was a pretty serious injury, so I can see why your veterinarian had the surgery done right away. It can take a long time for recovery, and 10 days, especially for a dog that didn't have deep pain, the fact that you are, you know, you are seeing some movement and sensation, that's amazingly good. I'm happy for you and your dog. Get involved with some physical therapy. I think that would be very helpful. As soon as your dog is, the incisions healed up enough that they can get into a, you know, underwater treadmill so they can have that support. They can start building up some of their muscle strength and you know, getting their balance and so on back. You know, definitely do that. But the incontinence, again, that's just one of those things where if the spinal cord has been damaged enough, the brain isn't picking up on the fact that the bladder's filling up, and so it may just be, you know, spilling over. I would hope that the veterinarian has showed you how to palpate your dog's abdomen and perhaps express the bladder if necessary, because that's something that's just part of the nursing care post disc surgery.
If we had all that, when you say a long time, how long is a long time?
Weeks to months. So, you know, it's not going to be overnight. I would say, you know, start, you know, maybe planning for, you know, Thanksgiving, celebrating then.
Mm-hmm. And because he had the slip disc at L4 and 5, does he have the chance of having other slip discs?
Well, I would hope that the when they did the workup to find out where the discs were, but typically we'll either do a myelogram or have an MRI done of the back, that they were able to identify other spots. Things that you would do to try to prevent issues down the road if there are other discs that are have aged and are potentially ready to slip out of place would be to make sure your dog isn't jumping, keeping them like off the furniture so they're not jumping up and down, or using the little stairs or ramps and so on to help prevent back injuries. Get your dog's weight under control if weight is an issue. Get weight loss going, and be looking at kind of long-term physical therapy so that they can maintain their muscle strength of their back to help protect it. So, yeah, mm-hmm. There are some things that you can do.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. And let's go to Viroqua next. Talk with Amber. Hi, Amber. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I have an English bulldog.
Mm-hmm.
She has, when I got her, everything was fine. Her coat was fine. Now she has these scabs.
Mm-hmm.
And they're kind of, I don't know how to explain it. Like, when you pick them off, they're kind of mucusy.
Okay. Yeah.
And I've used medicated shampoo, and that didn't work. She's on Canada.
Okay.
So I don't know.
Yeah, I think English Bulldogs are one of those breeds. I have two, so I know what it's like. When I travel, I have my whole medicine kit going along with me.
Yeah.
They tend to be dogs that are more prone to skin infections and problems, especially in their face folds and areas like that. Sounds like your dog may have a skin infection. And so going into your veterinarian, one of the things that they can do to help confirm whether there's an infection there or not is peel back one of those scabs and actually do a little impression smear with a glass slide, stain it and look under the microscope and see if there's, you know, lots of bacteria there. Often we will, for a first time infection, just get the dog going on an appropriate antibiotic for skin, which is usually either like a cephalexin is one of the ones that we'll use. There's another one called Clavamox, and it kind of depends on what your veterinarian likes to use, what they're comfortable with. If we've got a problem where the skin infections aren't clearing up or they're coming back, you know, very quickly afterwards, we'll sometimes do cultures. I've been seeing a lot of methicillin-resistant staph intermedius, which is kind of the dog version of our MRSA. And so,
oh, no.
Yeah, so, you know, I think that we're seeing more and more of that. So visit to your veterinarians in order to get your dog on the right path. And medicated shampoo, boy, sometimes, they don't have antibacterial agents in them, or they may just have, you know, a little bit of coal tar or something like that that may help with seborrhea. So you may be using the wrong shampoo, but that's that's part of the therapy, but usually not the only thing. And oral antibiotics.
I was thinking of possibly using Dawn dish soap since the antibacterial type, but I mean, I'm definitely going to take her to the vet. Because
yeah. And I wouldn't be using
infected.
Yeah, yeah, I wouldn't be using dish soap. It can be extremely irritating to the skin. That's meant for cutting grease on pots and pans, not for delicate bulldog skin. So avoid using dish soap, please.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You know, I'm thinking back here. The topic of ticks came up a little bit ago,
uh-huh.
And I'm wondering about getting rid of ticks,
yeah,
and removing ticks. What's the best way to remove a tick?
The best way is to actually either use a very fine tip tweezers, not the kind you would like pluck your eyebrows with, but something that comes to a fine point. What you'll find is that people will do all kinds of weird things, from putting nail polish on them. I even had somebody try to put gasoline on it, and it caused this burn the skin, caused all kinds of problems. So don't put petroleum jelly on. Don't put nail polish on. They need to be pulled out. And it's just a real good, steady, grab it down by the head and just pull right up, and you're going to end up getting a little piece of skin along with the head. Don't start, if you think that there's a little bit of tick still left in there, a little piece of the head, don't start picking at it, and you'll cause more infection. Usually the body will take care of it on its own. My favorite device, though, is this thing called the tick remover, which is just this little metal, flat piece of metal with a notch cut in it, and you can just slide that right underneath the tick and just keep pushing forward, and it traps the head and everything comes out. So straight up, don't squeeze the body. you know, don't use your bare fingers. Like, if you have to use your fingers, put a gauze over it so that you're not infecting yourself with anything that could be in the tick's body.
I think you kept one, or you used to keep one of those on your keychain.
I have it on my keychain. It just happens to be on my keychain at work in my pocket. So I don't have it with me right now, but I've been using it enough at work since we've been seeing lots of ticks.
And it works well on people, too.
It does. It does. Yep.
Joyce in Madison, your turn. Hi, Joyce.
Hello. I have an issue with my 5-year-old male greyhound, who's an adopted hound. He's 70 pounds, friendly guy, and he has a sizable corn on one foretoe and one hind toe.
Hmm.
My vet's not that familiar with greyhound corns, and he's been on Dermascent, the Biobomb. Not doing well.
Okay.
I've heard from other greyhound folk that sometimes a laser treatment is used, then the corn comes back. And I know about the Therapaw boots.
I've ordered two of those. Okay.
Do you have any other suggestions or tips? Since this is unique to greyhounds, a lot of people are unfamiliar with the situation.
Yeah, and you know what? I've never seen a greyhound with corns on their feet, but I would imagine that it's a function of the way they walk or run and, you know, developing some irritation with their feet. And I think your idea of using boots is a good idea. You know, anything that you can do to be able to pad the area so that it doesn't become like a big, you know, callous, irritated spot. There are some other things that are like pad agents that like Musher's Secret and things like that that can be used that are kind of moisturizing and yet protective as well. You may want to look into using something like that. But biopsying the pad or doing surgery on it, it's such a tough spot to do because it's so spongy. You can't put sutures in. They just pull out. So I would do anything you can to avoid having any surgery done. So I think the boots are a great idea.
All right.
Fantastic. Thank you very much.
Yep. Thanks very much for calling. An email from Matt in Green Bay. I recently got a new puppy named Tuck, a mini Aussie Shepherd, 10 weeks old. Got it from the vet. Back from the vet yesterday. Suffering right now from a sore throat and cough. The vet thinks he has kennel cough. We have him on medications to help him recover, but in the meantime, he's having a hard time sleeping because of the sore throat. Anything that...
Yeah, kennel cough is a tracheitis type problem where they develop a dry hacking cough. Sometimes, especially in young dogs, it can turn into pneumonia. They can be very sick. Sounds like the veterinarian is treating for that with an appropriate antibiotic. It's usually, kennel cough is a whole group of different bugs. Probably the main one that everyone knows about is Bordetella. But there's some other viruses and things that can affect the dog, too. We also worry about canine influenza, dogs with influenza, which is not parainfluenza, which is included in the vaccine, but canine influenza, the C3N8, I believe, is the bug. We are on the lookout for that. So when we have dogs that aren't responding to, you know, kind of standard kennel cough treatment, we start thinking, you know, do we have something like this going on? Usually they've run a fever and have a runny nose and are feeling pretty punky for several days until they, you know, just supportive care, they'll get over it. So I worry that your dog may have something more going on than kennel cough. And I've had dogs that have got into burdocks and chewed them out and irritated their throat. You know, be checking to make sure your dog doesn't have tonsillitis or something irritating, looking for foreign bodies back there. So it may mean if your dog isn't getting better, if we can't get a good look at the back of the throat, even sedation to be able to have a better look and see what's going on back there. But it sounds like it's more than kennel cough.
April in Stevens Point, thank you for waiting. Hello.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a cat, and she's indoor and outdoor, and she seems to get worms, like, more often than usual. I had talked with my vet, and we had decided that we were going to do treatment, like, every 6 months, but she just had a treatment, like, 3-4 months ago, and now it looks like she has tapeworms again.
Tapeworms are, most cats get tapeworms. There's two kinds of tapeworms that cats get. Mainly.
Okay.
There's some other ones that are kind of more oddball, but one of them is through eating rodents or rabbits. It's called tinea. And the other one is from ingesting infected fleas. And it's called dipolidium. And the Center for Disease Control says that if you've got a cat that's outdoors and hunting, thing, probably quarterly deworming. So every 3 months, and then also deworming when you actually see whether, you know, quarterly, whether you see something or not, if for an indoor outdoor cat, and then, you know, treatment, if you do see something between those episodes, because between dewormings, if your cat went out and ate another mouse or rabbit, they could be right back into, within a month or so, shedding those eggs, those segments again. So, and it's important because if this happens to be the tapeworm called Tinea, there's another tapeworm called Echinococcus that sometimes goes along for the ride. And this is why the Center for Disease Control has gone under, you know, is looking into this, because it's a health risk for people. Cats can live with them quite well, but it can be a pretty significant health risk for people. So keep your cat on a good deworming program. My favorite one for kitties is a topical spot-on product called Profender. Gets roundworms, hookworms, and tapeworms, and you don't have to give them a nasty tasting pill. It's just spotted on. And so that would be something you can get from your veterinarian.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. As long as we're on parasites, raccoons can carry a deadly parasite,
Baylis ascaris. Yes.
Baylis ascaris.
Yes. Okay. So we're just talking about, you know, deworming cats and dogs on a regular basis. You know, most people that have pets that are on heartworm preventative are automatically taking care of roundworms, because most of the heartworm preventatives do, you know, have that. But unfortunately, the raccoons that are out there, you know, coming to your deck at night or around your garbage cans, they're not on a regular deworming program. And almost all of them, according to a parasitologist friend of mine who's from Kansas State, almost all raccoons carry this particular roundworm. The big issue with it is that if humans get exposed, the infective stage, the larval stage, likes to migrate around our body and can cause a significant damage to tissues, including your brain. So, you know, keeping yourself away from it. If you have raccoons that are visiting, try to make sure that your trash is put away, that you're not trying to feed them. You know, that's just asking for trouble, and especially if you have pets. And so keep your pet on a standard dewormer to prevent them if they happen to be ingesting any of these like raccoon droppings or something like that. Some dogs can actually shed this. So it's a big, big problem. And I think we kind of look at raccoons as being these cute little bandits, but can be a significant health risk for everybody.
Ellen in Milwaukee, on to you. Hi, Ellen.
Hi. I thought I might have a mechanical help for the woman whose sister's dog or cat was peeing and pooping all over the place. We had a cat who had a lot of anxiety issues, and we had two cats, I think, at that time, and several dogs. And she, when she'd get anxious, and she was indoor, outdoor, and if we didn't let her out, she'd pee on things. I don't know how many sofas we went through. And eventually, when we were going to be out of town for a while, for a couple of weeks, and we didn't want the cat being outside too much with the babysitters here, I went and got like one of those ferret cages and worked with it, changed it so the door opened on the bottom and I could put a litter box in there, and I had a couple of shelves and put a couple blankets and stuff in there. And we put her in one bedroom in that and just shut her in there for 2 or 3 days. And then I told the sitters that they could let her in and out of there in that room. And then by the time we got back home, she was so comfortable using that as her security place that when we opened up the house and let her out, she used that. She would just go in there, and that was her litter box. She used it. She would just go in there and hang out. She was free to go anywhere. But she I think she felt so secure. And so, you know, even though it wasn't pretty.
But, you know, the fact that you added in, you added in an extra box, and that may be the whole thing, is that it was in a bedroom where she felt that she could be in a secure spot. The other cats, the other cat in the household wouldn't bother her, or the other dogs wouldn't bother her. I mean, I've had some owners say that, you know, their dogs are so into cleaning up after the cat, if you catch my drift, that, you know, they stand there hovering over the litter box waiting for the cat to, you know, finish doing their business. And you know, that can be pretty frightening for a cat that might be shy. So I'm glad this worked for you. I don't feel that your cat was probably retrained, but, you know, just giving her a secure spot that she felt comfortable in seemed to do the trick. So, and I don't think you really even need a cage per se, just, you know, a litter box in an area that the cat's comfortable in.
Hmm. That's excellent. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Just looking at our Facebook page here at the Larry Miller Show, and we've got lots of cute pictures coming up. Oh, look at this
one. Oh, little dogs. Oh, my goodness.
With his ear almost in the
coffee. In the coffee cup, yeah. Oh, my goodness. It looks like a little Chihuahua wiener dog, the new mixed breed, the Chiweenie. Yep. So
Chiweenies, okay.
That was, yeah. Yep.
Oh, here's the 10-year-old Roddy. And we've got
a boxer and, oh, two Aussie friends. Yep. Oh, my goodness. Yep.
Lots of cool pictures. Thanks. Keep them coming. We have Jason in Chippewa Falls next. Hi, Jason.
Hello. Step outside. It's a little quieter out here.
Okay.
I have a between 10 and 12-year-old German Shepherd.
Whoop. It sounds like we lost...
Them?
Yeah. Oh, well, I think the question was about an older dog with bad hips.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've already talked about weight control. And I think that that's, you know, really, really important. It definitely makes a huge difference for dogs to lose those extra pounds. But sometimes we need to, as dogs get older, be looking at adding in things like joint supplements, glucosamine, chondroitin sulfate are probably the two big ones that get used. But many dogs need pain medication as they get older just to be able to function. I had an owner in this morning with two dogs that are on a drug called Rimadyl, and although it's a relatively safe drug for the majority of dogs, it still requires some monitoring, especially in dogs that get older. And so her little, you know, 12-year-old dog, we ended up getting a little bit of blood work from the dog and some urine from her so that we can, you know, make sure that she's handling her medication and we're not causing any harm by using it. So, you know, if the hips are bothering your dog, talk to your veterinarian, get some lab work done. If everything comes back fine, get them on a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory. If we've got issues with the liver, kidneys, or other pain medications that we can use, the big one that I like is called Tramadol, and it's very helpful for dogs. It's a human medication that we're using frequently in dogs.
Pam in Alma Center, on to you now. Hi, Pam.
Hi there. I recently adopted a 2-year-old male Cocker Spaniel from a rescue facility. And he had been lost, and when they got him, he was quite flea-infested and ticks and all matted and quite a mess. He's just an absolutely wonderful dog now and just so well-behaved. My concern is he bites and itches yet and bites at his paws and itches and scratches. He doesn't have fleas. His skin is in good shape. And just wondering what other things I might do to kind of break that behavior.
Well, if somebody came in and with their pet to my office and said, my dog's chewing and biting, first thing I would do is run a flea comb through them, making sure they're on flea control, because one flea can trigger an allergic reaction in a flea-sensitive dog. So make sure that you've got your dog on a good flea and tick control agent. I'd be looking for other mites as well. There are other microscopic mites, scabies. There's another one called Calathiella, where you may not see a whole lot of skin changes until it's been, you know, sitting there for a long, long period of time. But the fact that this dog is, you know, did have external parasites, has been through rescue groups, you know, if it's had contact with other dogs, definitely would be on my radar. And the way we diagnose that is trying to do some skin scrapings where we look for the mites on the superficial layers of the skin. If we don't find them and we're still pretty suspicious of that, sometimes we'll just go through a therapeutic trial. And I like to use a topical medication that's also heartworm preventative called Revolution or Selamectin. That seems to be a good thing, very easy. It's a spot on. You just use it every couple of weeks to see if that makes your dog better. If they're still not improving with that and there's no other indication of yeast infections or bacterial infections that need to be treated, then I'd start looking into the allergy type workup. And sometimes we just end up therapeutically dealing with it. Kind of like if you have allergies and hay fever, you don't know exactly what you're reacting to, but you take antihistamines and certain things to be able to make yourself be able to function during the day. We do the same thing with dogs. There are medications that we can use, but some people choose to try to find out what the dog's actually allergic to, and we'll go through allergy testing. And it can be quite involved. So I start from the basics, look for external parasites, and that might not be something, unless you're really got microscopic eyes, you're going to need to take your dog into a veterinarian to have that looked into.
Okay, and I've had him into the vet and didn't see any signs of it either, you know, and he had been treated and you know, was cleaned up and things like that. But the medication you mentioned, the topical, the Revolution.
Revolution.
That's something that's prescribed to the veterinarian?
Yes, it is. It is a prescription product. You can get it online as well, but you do need a prescription from your veterinarian to even get it online.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. And Diane in Mercer, on to you now. Hi, Diane. Let's a second here. There we go. Hi, Diane.
Hi. I have a black lab golden retriever, and I live on a lake, and she swims, like, as soon as the ice is kind of out. And then till whenever it goes in. And she smells most of the time. And so I try to dry her off, and I've been wiping her off with antibacterial hand wipes in the areas where she smells, because 2 years ago she did have, I think it was a staph or strep infection. And but now her tail has a real irritated spot, and there's been really bad flies, so I don't know if it was the flies biting her there. So I've been cleaning that off and putting ointment on it.
It's you know, I'd be concerned a couple of things. Antibacterial wipes that are used, you know, they, like human wipes and so on, usually just have like an alcohol type thing in them, and they can be a little irritating, especially if you've got open sores on your dog's skin, which it sounds like you do. Our dermatologists, though, when we've had a dog with kind of chronic skin infections that we can get under control with, you know, medical management with oral, the appropriate oral antibiotic, sometimes when dogs get recurrent problems like this, we'll use a dairy teat wipe, and they're called Nissan wipes. I think it's N-I-S-S-A-N. They seem to work very well for dogs where you can, you know, just they sell them in big buckets and you can wipe your dog down with them. And but, you know, with the smell that you're getting, it could be that your dog has a skin infection, an ear infection. It may just be that if they've been jumping in, especially if there's any algae or, you know, plant material type things in the water, that'll get attached to the skin and start to ferment and almost get like that silagey type smell. And these are dogs that sometimes just need to be bathed with a gentle shampoo after every time they get it in and out of the water. So make sure you're washing your dog's bedding as well. That can be another source of odor. And wash the collar. Whenever you wash your dog's collar as well, because that can, again, harbor some of the odor too. So, but it sounds like that sore on the tail might be something that needs to be taken care of, especially if it's attracting flies. The last thing you want is maggots.
Thank you very much for calling. I appreciate your call. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, professor of veterinary medicine at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you'd like to join in our conversation as we talk about your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, call us at 800-642-1234, email talk at WPR.org, or post a comment or maybe a photo on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd love to see those as well. I have an email from Aaron, Sandy. It says, I'm just curious about your feelings about not measuring out food, but always leaving food out and allowing the dog to eat whenever they want. We did this with both of our dogs from the time they were puppies. In their 13 to 15 years of life, they always maintained an ideal weight.
Oh, she was a lucky, lucky pet owner. Yeah, those dogs are few and far between that can self-regulate. I kind of equate having a full food dish down as like going on a cruise ship where there's food available 24 hours a day. I don't know anybody that goes on a cruise that doesn't come back gaining weight. And it just, it happens. You know, if the food's there, they're going to eat it. And so it becomes something that, you know, even if they're not even that hungry, they may just keep going back to the food bowl. So she's been very, very lucky. And I would not be expecting this to be something that happens with future pets. The big problem that I see too is, besides, you know, that most free-fed dogs are overweight, is that when we're feeding a young growing dog and leaving them with food where they can just kind of self-regulate 24 hours a day, there is a strong association with just free choice feeding with increased risk of orthopedic disease. So for large breed dogs, this is a very inappropriate way to feed them.
Scott in Highland, on to you now. Hi, Scott.
Hi, I've got my questions are actually pertaining more to behavior than health, if that's okay.
That's all right.
I've got an Australian Shepherd mix that's 7 months old, and I have two questions. One is, I live in the country and raise beef cattle, and so my goal is to have her eventually herding cattle for him.
Mm-hmm.
And so at a younger age, I wanted her to be comfortable with them, so I let her be around them, and I had her help me move them a little bit and that kind of thing. And she really loves it, and she loves it too much now.
Uh-oh. So, okay.
Yeah. So when the cows come up to the field near the house, the field that she's helped me drive them out of before, now she takes it upon herself to drive them out of it whenever
yeah.
they come up.
Yeah, if you're going to be having a dog that's going to be a working dog, it needs to be well-trained. It can't just be doing, whenever it wants to. It has to be on your command. So I'd go back to the basics. Your dog should have an excellent recall, that you have a whistle, a word, something that you use to get the dog to be right back and at your side, and then going out and working the cattle only when told to do so. So, basic obedience would be a good start. And then actually working with someone that does, training on herding. And it may mean, working with something a little more manageable, like sheep to start with. And there are, many groups out there that help with, sheepdog training. And so that what might be a good place to be looking. So contact
Yeah, that was my plan when she gets maybe 9 months or so, because that's kind of what I've been reading as recommended starting age.
Yeah.
But maybe given the circumstances, I want to start sooner.
Yeah, and this is something back, way back 50 years ago, they used to say, oh, don't start training your dog until they're 7 or 8 months of age. But, now the swing is, for the last, as long as I've been a veterinarian, is dogs are learning every single minute of their life. And so training starts the day you get your dog. And that would have been a perfect time to get your dog enrolled in like puppy training classes that maybe start with kindergarten and then, keep working. Good, good.
And we did that. And you're right about the recall. She's not especially good at that, so I need to
work on that.
Definitely that would be the first place
absolutely.
To start. Work on that before you start letting her just have access to the fields without you.
Mm-hmm. Good luck.
And then the other thing is about jumping up. I've been reading conflicting stories on what to do jumping up. So
you have to deal with jumping up before it happens. And so if you can anticipate what your dog, that you're walking in the door and the dog's jumping on you, then this is the time to, again, pull out that early obedience and ask your dog to sit and have their fanny on the ground. You greet your dog while they're sitting. Doing all the things like, kneeing the dog, squeezing their feet. I mean, that gravity lets the dog go down and they're still going to want to jump up. But just, work on how do you want her to greet you? By sitting in front of you and wagging her tail and being a good little dog. So, keep reinforcing that and not allowing her to be in the position where she's jumping up.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Gina in Green Bay may have a similar type of question, too. Gene, hi.
Hello.
What can I do for you?
Well, I guess I'm having a similar problem. Our dog is a 7-month-old collie, and we've just had continual problems with him jumping and jumping and jumping on us, on anybody that comes to the house.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And, part of the problem is my skin is so fragile that he's tearing my skin so badly.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness.
And I just am to the point where I don't know what to do anymore.
Well, I would, first of all, be working with a professional trainer. And again, just like I told the last person, your dog needs to have a good sit or down stay. So that would be a good place to be starting. Remember, any time if the dog jumps up and we're pushing the dog down, the dog's getting attention. And so if you notice that the dog is going to jump up on you, take a step backwards so that they can't hit you, they can't jump on you. And when all four feet are on the ground, then ask the dog to sit and give the dog attention that way. The other thing you can do is just turn your back on the dog. And I've worked with a couple of trainers that really like, and I was just so impressed with just the person being lasting long enough with the, just keep turning around so the dog isn't being touched by you. They're not getting any facial cues from you. And as soon as the dog, is down with all four feet on the ground, they use a clicker and they click and treat. So the dog learns, oh, feet on the ground. That's how I get attention. So it may be something that you're just not going to be able to do on your own just to get the timing right. And that's where it really helps I've even, you know, I take my own dogs to training classes because, hey, you know, even though I'm a veterinarian, I don't see the mistakes that I'm making, whereas a good trainer will, and be able to help you with getting this problem under control.
Yep, there you go. Thank you very much for calling. Email from Tim in West Bend. I've always believed my cat doesn't eat enough. My wife states it's the breed, part Siamese, but she eats only one full can of cat food every day. She does graze on food, but I still find the low amount of food concerning. The vet says she's very healthy at 13, extremely skinny, about 6 pounds, and has not gained any weight in the 13 years since she's been part of our life.
Yeah, it may just be this is the cat's normal weight. And I see so often kitties that are normal weight that people will say, oh, they're too skinny, but they're actually normal. So this just may be the cat's set point. And as long as she's not losing weight, she's taking in enough calories to be able to maintain her weight. And that's what counts. But be on the lookout for weight loss, because especially as they get older, there's a lot of things that can happen that can cause their weight to drop, such as hyperthyroidism and kidney disease. So, you know, have your cat checked out if you think that they are losing weight. But this may be the cat's set point, and they're lucky because it's a
13-year-old cat.
That's maintained a good, healthy body weight. So, yeah.
That's absolutely amazing,
mm-hmm.
for sure. Well, by the way, the woman who that wants her to save her sister's cat heard the call for more suggestions and wanted to say thank you, Sandy.
Nice? We've even got callers helping us. Yeah.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today. She'll be with us right up until 12:30 on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, talking your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Thanks to her for being with us, and thank you for listening in. We have lots of callers online, so I think we'll just go right to the phones. And Ross in Madison, your turn. Hi, Ross.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Sandy.
Hi.
I've got a 3-year-old Jack Russell and then an 11-year-old Jack Russell. But the 3-year-old we take to here in Madison, we take it to the dog park that has access to the lake. And it seems like the lake's kind of muddy, kind of green with all this algae and stuff that they talk about. And then it seemed like we noticed that she had kind of a rash. And he seemed to be scratching a bit more. And I guess I'm wondering, obviously it could be a source of the itching. What do you think I should do?
Well, we don't see rashes in dogs very often. And typically when we get little like red dots, it's because they have folliculitis or inflammation of the hair follicles, which is usually an infection.
Right.
So getting that checked out and being, you know, treating it appropriately. Be really careful around the lakes. When we've got algae blooms, especially like with blue-green algae, it can be quite toxic for dogs. Trying to avoid going into any lakes that, you know, have visible algae, and that's a problem because every lake around here is like that. So, and then bathing your dog after being in the lake like that, hosing them down, actually going home, getting some shampoo so that you're not leaving any of the organic residue on your dog's skin, which can be irritating and a source of odor, as we talked about in the previous hour.
Yeah, good. Okay, good. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Amy in Eagle River, on to you. Hi, Amy.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Fine, thanks for calling.
I'm calling because I have a border collie lab mix. We got her from the shelter a couple of years ago, and when we first got her, she would eat her food in her dish, but she slowly got into the point where she's pushed it out of her dish, and now she just won't eat her food in a dish at all.
Mm-hmm.
So we scoop it out onto a mat, and she pushes it she stuffs it and pushes it into the corner, and then she'll eat it.
Huh. You know, I've had dogs that had their tags get caught on the dish, or they bang on the dish and it scares them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that looking for something like that, is it, you know, just mechanically causing her some troubles? It's a very odd eating behavior to be, you know, but it sounds like it's working for her. She's got a firm edge she can push the food up to.
Yep.
I don't know if, you know, one of the things that I've had people try for dogs that like to do this kind of thing are they make these little triangular litter boxes for ferrets where the front end is very shallow. It has maybe about a 1-inch lip on the front, and then it's 6 to 8 inches plus high in the back. And they're triangular. They sit in a corner because ferrets like to go to the bathroom in a corner. And okay. Those have sometimes worked really well for some dogs that like to have something that they can push the food up into where, and because the front lip is so low, tags and things like that don't rub on it. So it might be something to look into. Like, you know, mm-hmm. yeah, it's not sure. a dog dish, but it would work for your dog.
All right. That sounds like a good suggestion. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks a lot for calling. And by the way, you suggested on a show a few months back about a watering device.
Yeah.
That sort of runs water,
like a fountain, yes.
Like a fountain. And uh-huh. We actually bought one of those.
Is it working?
It works great.
Good.
The cats love it.
You know, there's several different models on the market, and some of them look like a waterfall. And this one happens to be a little spigot that comes up through the top. And
yeah.
And then you can adjust it to either be like a waterfall all the way around or as you know, like a dripping faucet. And that's what some cats like. So that's great. It encourages them to drink. And you just got to make sure that it doesn't get limed up and that you keep it clean.
We have Trevor in Jefferson online next. Trevor, hi.
Hi. I just got a Chesapeake Bay Retriever puppy. It was a week ago, actually. She's only 9 weeks old. And ever since we've gotten her, she's had very loose stools, loose and often stools. And the breeder didn't mention anything about that when we got her. And I specifically called her back and asked. I've heard that maybe when puppies have a new environment, their nervousness will bring that out. I'm just wondering if it's something I should see the vet about now. I mean, her eating habits are still regular, and she has her appointment for her second set of shots at the end of the month. So I guess I just wonder, should I wait or should I?
I'd contact your veterinarian now. The number one thing that we see in puppies that causes, probably the two things that I would think of, one would be internal parasites.
Okay.
And just because a stool sample is checked and you're not seeing the parasite, it doesn't mean that your pet doesn't have them. Probably one of the more common ones that we are diagnosing is a parasite called Giardia. Many adult dogs can live with it and not have any symptoms. Many puppies end up with diarrhea, especially with some mild stressors like changing to a new home or changing the diet. Taking in a fresh stool sample, definitely. Having it looked at, having your veterinarian do a fecal flotation, you may want to also ask them to do a Giardia antigen test, which is a special little test that picks up proteins from the Giardia organism. They can sometimes be hard to find on a standard fecal flotation. And then even if they're negative, I would still be looking at giving your puppy a broad-spectrum dewormer. The one I usually use in these cases is one called Fenbendazole or Panacure. And that would be a prescription product that your veterinarian would have to get for you. I'd also be looking at diet for your dog. Find out what the breeder was using before, because sometimes just different foods, even though, you know, you're at the pet store and you're like, wow, this is like the best diet. It's like, you know, look at this. It's everybody likes it. Every dog's an individual, and it may just be that the food that you're using is too rich for your dog as well. But get the parasites off the table first before you start thinking about diet changes.
Okay. Yeah, right. That sounds good. Thanks.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. On our Facebook page, Michelle wonders which tick removal tool that you referred to earlier. There are a couple on the market.
Yeah. The one that I have, I actually got at one of the like hunting stores, and it's just called the tick remover. It's a little metal thing about the size of my baby finger. Larry, you said it looks like something that you would use for like repairing like little divots or like
right.
when you are driving onto the
green.
Greens. Yeah. Looking for something like that. They also make one in a spoon-like form that looks like a measuring spoon with a notch cut in it. And I don't know what that one's called, but you'll see them everywhere as well. That works. The one that I don't like is they make these like special tweezers for removing ticks that are spring loaded. They're too cumbersome and they squish the body of the tick, which may inadvertently push the organisms into the dog prematurely or cat prematurely.
Mm-hmm.
So, either using very narrow, fine pointed tweezers or one of these other tick devices that just actually kind of rocks the tick out.
Let's turn to Jill in Rice Lake now. Jill, hi.
Hello.
What's on your mind?
Okay, I'm going to be talking about not my dog, but my son's dog, and she's 13-year-old Husky, and I don't mean to romanticize this at all. I don't want to be dramatic, but I was told by a vet last week that it's time to just end this, end the testing, end all of this, mm-hmm. and let her go. She's had a good run. The thing, Patricia, that I'm questioning is whether to put her to sleep. She's been a very, very dignified, self-sufficient protector. Mm-hmm. You know, she's just this wonderful, regal animal. And something in me is saying that to end her time, like to make this decision for her is like undignified for her. And
yeah, it's
like she takes everything in life as this is my job.
Yeah.
And I will do my job. And now my job is to go away and, you know, and my life comes to an end.
Oh, you know,
and
this
I
is,
really don't want to upset her.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. This you're dealing with one of the toughest decisions that a pet owner has to make. Letting a dog die naturally, especially if they have long term chronic diseases.
She has a cancer.
Yeah. It's guaranteed that by the time they get to the point where they are, you know, going to die naturally, they've been suffering. I mean, unless you are practicing really good hospice care with appropriate pain medication and proper nursing care and nutritional management and fluid therapy
and
so on.
Oh, boy, have I been doing that all summer. But my son said to me last week, Mom, she needs to come home now. You know, I want to take care of this. And but that's fine. But he's at work and everybody's at work and I'm dying here.
Yeah. And so you're being the nurse and seeing this dog every day. And if your son cannot provide that type of care that, and you know, you and your son know your dog better than anybody else. But if you feel that, the things that make your dog, like maybe she's not greeting you or the things that she would normally do, like barking when the doorbell rang or, that she was well housebroken and now she's having accidents. Those are all things that are going to really affect the dog's quality of life. And so if her mobility's poor, her appetite's poor, she's, you know, socially not being as responsive, sometimes it's better to say, you know what, I would rather end my dog's life a week too early than let them suffer one day too long.
I see.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, for the vet to say to me a week ago Monday, Jill, it's time now. We stop this.
Yeah. And we don't say that lightly. You know, if we feel that the dog has a chance of having good quality of life, we will be there and just, you know, cheer you on if you can provide the care for your pet. But it sounds like your son may not be able to provide the care, that it's at the point where if you've already got one veterinarian saying that it's time, it probably is.
Probably is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. So, okay. Am I projecting human emotions on her to think she's going to be insulted?
Yes, you are. Yes, you are. And I think what you're doing is taking your own emotions and saying, I can't make this decision. But, you know, I think that if dogs could talk, they'd be asking us, probably sooner rather, you know, than we think. So put your own feelings aside and actually be looking at her and, you know, very, very, all those things, you know, eating, drinking and so on. We'll see dogs eating right up to the end. So that can't be the only thing that you look at. You've got to look at the whole picture to make a decision, but it sounds like it's time.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Oh boy. Those are always tough, isn't it?
They are. Yeah.
Gene and Rhinelander, we turn to you next. Hi, Gene.
Hi there. I have a rescue who is now 6 years old, and about a year ago, she was diagnosed with bladder cancer. It was caught very early because I had a bunch of tests done to determine why she kept having all these infections. Well, the bottom line was that she's on medication. She's doing really, really well. But my question is,
how do I tell if it's getting worse and if treatment needs to be changed?
Yeah, typically, you know, bladder cancer doesn't usually have a really good prognosis for most dogs. I'm not sure what kind of cancer she had. I hope that if it was removed, they did get a biopsy done. To be able to find out what kind it was. But, things to be watching for, even just having a urine sample checked periodically. Some of the cancers that affect the bladder, the abnormal cells that usually the typical bladder cancer we see is a transitional cell type of cancer. That's the lining of the bladder wall. And if you start seeing some atypical transitional cells, that would be, a clue that we've got something going on. Perhaps it may just be, increased bleeding or, like you said, recurrent infections. So, periodically having a clean urine sample looked at, I think would be a good idea for a dog like this.
Okay, is there then another step in treatment, or is that like the beginning of the end?
Sometimes surgical management depends on where the cancer is located, whether it's even possible or not. I know some of these dogs that our oncology unit works with, they have chemotherapy protocols that some dogs respond to for a period of time. And remember, when we're doing chemo, our goal is to provide the dog with a good quality of life. We're not looking at, trying to put them into remission or, having all their hair fall out and having them be nauseated because we're kind of look at the whole chemotherapy thing in a kind of different light, quality of life for the dog.
Yeah, there we go.
I really don't want to go down that road because I've had friends who did that and I thought it was just a tragedy. But
I've done it with one of my dogs and he had a good 6 months and he loved going into the clinic. He had no problem, never was sick with his chemotherapy. And I had a wonderful 6 months with him. And so, yes, people say, well, it was only 6 months, but in dog years, that's a long time. And I wouldn't, I wouldn't have taken those few months away from him. He enjoyed life and I enjoyed having him with me.
Yeah, good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. We have an email from John in Wausau. I have an 11-year-old black lab who has very heavy breathing, even with the recent cooler temperatures. Is this a concern? He's in otherwise good health and active, normal appetite, not overweight. He seems to breathe normally when sleeping. Is this normal aging or is an exam recommended?
My number one diagnosis for this would be a condition called laryngeal paralysis, where the vocal cords, instead of moving as the dog breathes in and out, just kind of hang in the airway. And so when dogs are awake and active and they're trying to get air in, they're moving past these vocal cords that are hanging there and it creates kind of a real hoarse breathing. Yeah. Sometimes there's even a voice change as well when they're barking. So it can be a pretty serious problem, especially on hot, humid days. They can't pant as effectively. So the problem is getting a diagnosis. You have to have the dog sedated to go back in and have a look at the back of the throat and watch those vocal cords move. We just had a dog in recently that we thought probably had laryngeal paralysis, and instead it ended up having a laryngeal tumor that was growing and causing some obstruction. So getting an exam done sooner rather than later, I think, is in order.
And Aaron emailed to say, I have a beautiful cat who was recently diagnosed with stomatitis about a year ago. To date, she's had all of her teeth pulled, didn't solve the problem. She's on a liquid Tremadol for pain, 1.3 milliliters twice per day. And about 2 weeks ago, she was put on prednisolone. Alone.
Okay.
5 milligrams twice a day. Seems to be helping, but if we do not give her the Tremadol, she drools. We're told this is a sign of pain. I've been told we're doing everything we can.
Yeah, I mean, I think it might not be a bad idea to have your veterinarian contact one of our board-certified dentists at the veterinary school. Sometimes when we have kitties that have chronic stomatitis, they respond better to, it's an antibiotic, but we're not using it for its antibacterial properties, but called doxycycline. And it does have some kind of an immune modulating effect. And for many cases of stomatitis, stomatitis, some of these cats respond fairly well to that, and so it might be something to consider trying. I always worry about long-term steroid use because it can affect, and that's what this prednisolone is a steroid, can affect the skin, can affect the liver, can affect the adrenal glands. So, you know, trying to keep that to a minimum. Tramadol is just a pain medication, and so if it does, if your cat is improving on tramadol, then it's a good indication that your cat probably is in pain, and it may be time to, you know, have your kitty looked at by somebody that is an oral surgeon and maybe can give your veterinarian and you some extra help.
James in Duluth, Minnesota. On to you. Hi, James.
Yes, good afternoon. I would like to ask your guest whether veterinary schools have made any studies on food-grade diatomaceous earth as an organic anti-parasite alternative to pharmaceutical poisons?
Yeah, there's a product that is on the market that, and I think it's, I can't even remember what it's called, but it's a diatomaceous earth that you actually, you know, beat into your carpets, and it will help with scratching and drying out the cuticle of the larval stage of the flea. And so it can, to some degree, help cut down on flea infestations. But the big risk of it is that, it's, you know, very fine, statically charged material. It can be damaging to electronic equipment and things like that, and it needs to be applied appropriately. But other than that, there's for use in the environment, but nothing that would work on a pet. You can maybe try it for the environmental control, but it's not going to control ticks and it's not going to control fleas on the dog.
Thank you for calling. A Facebook question from Kristen. If you have a cat that's prone to developing struvite,
crystals,
what do you recommend? What diet do you recommend?
Well, struvite crystals are, it depends, I have to say, it really depends. Sometimes if we collect a urine sample from a cat and just let it sit on the counter for half an hour and have it come to room temperature, crystals are going to come out of solution. So I'd be evaluating whether these crystals are actually a problem for the cat or whether it's just, hey, you know, the vet didn't look at the urine right away. So a hot off the press urine sample is the first thing. If your cat is developing clinical signs of having either urinary tract obstructions or blood in the urine with lots of crystals and is, you know, really got an irritated bladder wall, then the diet that you would want to use would be a acidifying low magnesium diet. Most vets now are prescribing a diet that is helpful for two different kinds of stones, struvite and oxalate. One of the brands happens to be CD Multi, which the Hills Company makes. I believe that there's one called SO Diet, Struvite Oxalate Diet. Those are usually the ones that we prescribe. But again, if your cat isn't having any symptoms and they're just finding crystals, is it normal for the cat? Look at when the urine sample was looked at.
And an email from Jason. My mother has a miniature American Eskimo, and when he sheds in spring, she cuts his coat short. I've tried to tell her that this is not appropriate to stop shedding or to keep them cool. She insists on it. I would like to hear your thoughts on this issue with a double-coated dog.
Well, you don't get a double-coated dog that has all that undercoat unless you really like to brush them. And I agree. I don't like to see these dogs shaved. I feel that their skin is then more exposed to getting sunburned and so on. It does provide not only winter insulation, but also helpful in the summer as well. So just extra grooming. It might make it a little bit easier, so you're not going to have as much hair around the house. But you got to be very, very careful with going out in the sunshine with these dogs that are shaved.
A caller in the UP wondered what might happen if a cat with a wet nose touched an electric fence.
Ooh. I wouldn't
be happy.
I probably wouldn't be happy. So, if you've got indoor-outdoor cats, be thinking twice if you're going to be installing an electric fence to keep your livestock in.
Well, I tell you what, we've gone through many calls, and I'm so sorry we didn't get to everybody, and so many emails. Thanks to everybody who's emailed in. Thanks to all of the great photos that came into the Facebook page. This is some great one. If you haven't been to our Facebook page, go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page and take a look, because there are lots of really cool photos and some good questions we didn't get to. Sandy, thank you so much.
Hey, you are welcome.
She will be back on September 13th.
Yes.
I have you down. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, professor of veterinary medicine at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Great to have her along, and she will be back. Tomorrow at 11, we'll learn about daylilies and how those easy-to-care and grow flowers can be a great addition to your landscape. And then at 11:45, we'll find out about the current Operation Deer Watch survey, plus other wildlife counting efforts and how to get involved. Stay with us.